You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome to Blue Republican Radio. We're for the liberty, curious. My name is Robin Kerner, and I am speaking today with a very good friend of mine and a tireless patriot and teacher for liberty, Chris Ann Hall. Chris Ann, how are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on your show, Robin.
Well, it is a pleasure. I am actually only reciprocating a kind gesture that you showed me not very long ago, am I not?
Oh, so you're telling me the only reason I'm on your show is I have you on mine. Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. But I think we've got a good thing going here, right?
We do, very much so.
I should tell my listeners that Chris Ann, as I said, not only is she an extraordinary liberty activist throughout the United States, and when I say throughout the United States, I think I mean that more than I could mean it of anybody. but she and I are friends, having shared two dinners together in Seattle not too long ago, two dinners in one evening.
And that's all it took, though, because we just instantly united, instantly.
Now, okay, so I'm just going to throw it over to you. Over what, Chris Ann, did we unite?
Oh, British history and the liberty that is inherent, not only in our hearts and souls, but throughout the history. We understand that liberty is inherent. It is not given to us by government, but it is bought by men and women who are willing to fight for it. And that history that we have here in the United States was born out of the battles in Great Britain to secure greater liberties from kings. And you and I have that kindred spirit.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of, we've kind of come at the same history and we get excited about the same things from different ends, in a way, right? I came from the land from which the liberty came, in a sense, and you come from the land in which that liberty has been crystallized, perhaps more than anywhere else.
I almost said where that liberty is dying, but I'm trying not to be too pessimistic today.
Well, we always have that sense, don't we? We always have that sense. But you know what? I think, and I'm going to ask you to talk about on this show some of the more important things that you teach about the history of liberty, the history of the Anglo political tradition, philosophical tradition, you might say. But I think throughout what we now, and we'll talk about this too, what now is an 1,000-year-long tradition, I think probably there wasn't a decade where people who cared weren't desperate for what they were worried about losing.
Well, no, that's absolutely true, because liberty is born out of a continual struggle. The struggle where government wants more power, because governments never choose to be republics. If government was given a choice, they would always be totalitarian, because that gives them all the power. And governments want more power, and the more power governments have, the less liberty people have. But people always want to have more liberty. So it's this constant tug of war throughout history. I'm reminded of an Irishman. His name's John Philpott Curran. He was speaking at a gubernatorial race in Dublin, Ireland, and he said, it is the common fate of the indolent to see their liberty stolen by the active. He said, the condition upon which God grants liberty man is eternal vigilance. And if that condition be broken, servitude is his punishment and the immediate indication of his guilt. So what we're really, really gathering from Quran is the fact that there is this constant struggle with immediate results. Immediate results for any letting go of either side.
Yeah. And would you say, Chris Ann, and this is something I seem to be talking about a lot, that usually when a big step is taken in history, towards liberty, when the ratchet is turned a notch in the right direction, it is, and I think you were kind of indicating this, in reaction to an attempt to turn the ratchet in the opposite direction, an attempt by power to turn the ratchet in the favor of power.
Well, absolutely, because it is. It's a constant pull. And that's why we have to be eternally vigilant. At any moment when we fall asleep, you know, as a society, we become apathetic or stop paying attention to what the government is doing, then the government is immediately going to take advantage of that and pull more power to itself. So I think the real struggle is to get the people to be vigilant, because governments are always vigilant. Governments
That's
are
right.
always searching more power, and so we as a people have a responsibility to be the active ones, you know?
Now, what you do, Chrisanne, why I love what you do, why you're just so effective, is because you have basically given your life to getting people to be more vigilant for their liberty, right? Can just tell my listeners a little bit about kind of what you do, what a typical week is for you.
Well, I have no typical week. My life is in utter disarray at all times. But I, what I do is I travel around the country, and I teach the things that have not been taught for decades and correct the things that have been taught wrong for decades. And in doing that, what I end up teaching is what I call the genealogy of the Constitution. And I call it the genealogy because I think it's just that important. So if someone had a time machine, Robin, and went back in time and killed your great-great-grandfather, you wouldn't be here, right?
Right.
Well, but those there are five documents that had to be written over 700 years before Thomas Jefferson could have plagiarized and created the Declaration of Independence.
I love how irreverently you put that. Now, just give us the list. Them off for us. What are the five documents that you're referring to?
Okay. The 1100 Charter of Liberties, produced by Henry I, in 1100, the Magna Carta of 1215, produced by the people in 1215, and then every document after that is the people. So we have the 1100 Charter of Liberties, the Magna Carta of 1215, the Petition of Right of 1628 against Charles I, the Grand Remonstrance of 1641 against Charles I again, and the English Bill of Rights of 1688 or 1689 against James II. And if you read those five documents, you understand that Thomas Jefferson did not write the Declaration of Independence as an original document. He simply picked pieces from the previous five and brought them into his day and his time.
Yeah, I like to say that those men of history did the work so that the founders didn't have to.
Right, right. But
which
the problem is
cheeky, because the founders were geniuses and they did an awful lot of work. But
but they were raised with that knowledge.
Right.
You know, when you think about it, Robin, the documents that we call the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, those were articles published in newspapers, mm-hmm. things that everyday people had common knowledge of. And today, people won't read them. Oh, they're too hard to read. You know, it's because we don't – if you did a man-on-the-street poll and asked somebody, have you read the Treatise of Locke, of John Locke? Most people would look at you cross-eyed like, what? Locke? Who? But if you went back in James Madison's day and asked the men on the street, have you read the Treatise of Locke? They'd say, oh, yes, of course we have. And you would have this conversation on natural law or whatever, you know, what aspect of his treatise. We are a ridiculously uneducated people today.
And what you do, Chrisanne, is you go around the country, not getting a lot of sleep, putting that right as best as you can, right? One class at a time, 200 and something classes a year.
I taught 265 lessons last year in 22 states.
So you might say, I would say you are a true traveling constitutional scholar and teacher.
Well, a scholar in the term that I'm still studying.
Right.
Not scholar in the term that I'm an expert. If we put it that way, because I don't think that I would ever be I would ever achieve in my own satisfaction the title of expert, because it's something that I think that we must continually study. I am teaching myself all the time. Every time I read something new, and I'm reading again and again, because you know we repeat history.
Right. Well, this is the famous Twain quote, isn't it? You know, history doesn't repeat exactly, but it does rhyme.
Right. Well, but you know what? When people go through my history lessons, they see just how precisely
yes.
we are repeating history.
I do agree with you.
Even, Twain was a little off the mark there, you know?
He understated it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think Solomon had it right when he said there's nothing new under the sun.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Now, it's so interesting. I mean, you're talking, you know, I made a comment in an article that I wrote recently that I discussed on your show, that it's kind of crazy for us. It's a kind of some combination of ignorance and arrogance to think that we might be any good at maintaining and protecting the legacy the founders gave us if we don't seek to learn what it was the founders knew in the first place. How can
Absolutely.
We be more effective than them with less knowledge than them? Because we're certainly not cleverer.
Well, you know, and I loved that. That was a brilliant observation. And it's absolutely true. Jefferson said, if you wish to be ignorant and free, you wish for what never was and never will be. The problem is the arrogance arises from this, Robin. The fact that we are so...
I tell you what, Chrisanne, hold on to the thought what okay. it arises from, because we're about to go into our break and we'll come back.
Okay.
Welcome back. You are with me, Robin Koerner, the original Blue Republican, and my wonderful, wonderful guest and good friend, Chrisanne Hall. And when we went into the break, I had thrown out there the thought that it's the height of arrogance for us in the Liberty Movement to think that we could protect the legacy that the founders gave us without trying, at least, to educate ourselves in the body of knowledge on which they drew when they gave us this legacy. And Chrisanne, you were about to explain where you think that kind of arrogance comes from.
Well, I believe that the arrogance comes from a misconception that we are, that because we are so technologically advanced, we have to be intellectually advanced, as if it's some kind of a correlative response. But in reality, it has the opposite effect. Because we're so technologically advanced, we don't have to work for what we can find. You don't have to read books anymore. You can read sound bites. You can listen to sound bites. You can read quotes. We have a society built on headlines in 140 characters or less. Just because we are drowning in information doesn't mean that we're not starving for education. And so the arrogance comes because of the availability that we have, but it doesn't equate to intelligence. Or knowledge.
Right, right. And you know what? There's also an element, I guess, of you can't know what you don't know, right? I mean, if nobody has ever taught you, has even said to you
right.
that there is a rich tradition out of which the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and, of course, the Declaration of Independence was drawn, if nobody had told you that it existed, you wouldn't go looking, would you? Why would you even think of such a thing?
No, and that's why, you know, I love teaching when I teach, Robin, because when I'm traveling around and I'm teaching that very thing, the roots of liberty, where it came from, how we got it, what it means, and I'm watching the people's faces transform as this knowledge becomes their own, and they start connecting the dots, and the light bulbs go on, and they're like, wow. I had no idea. Wow, that makes so much sense. Oh, my goodness, why didn't we teach this before? What are we going to do? I taught a group of women this afternoon, and one of the ladies stood up and she said, oh, Chrisanne, I wish you had been my history teacher. And so people are hungry for this. I taught. Yeah. I teach college students sometimes on campus. I get lucky, and I get a real conservative professor who's really concerned about teaching historical truth and that sort of thing. And so I was invited in one time, and I started teaching this genealogy of the Constitution. And I had one young lady start pounding on her desk and I, in the middle of my presentation, and I said, would you like to say something? She said, oh, yes. And she has her fists clenched very, very tightly, so tightly that you can see that her knuckles are turning white, and she's shaking them at me. And she says to me, please tell me, why have we been lied to our entire education? See, people don't believe lies because they went around, oh, let's go search out all the lies that we can believe today. They believe lies because they've been taught them to be true. But when they're exposed to the truth and they're exposed to facts that they've never seen before, it's absolutely invigorating.
Yes, it is. Yeah, this is it's true. I mean, you know, in a sense, I know that, you know, you can argue that the United States is an anti-intellectual culture, and there's a lot of truth in that. And, you know, we have massive problems in our education system, and, you know, we don't equip our young people really to get into some of the more important things that are critical to making them good citizens. That may all be true, but truth is very exciting. I think it is part of human nature that when you receive a truth that connects to your life, to what you believe in a deep and important way. First of all, it's kind of self-verifying, but also it just elevates you. I mean, it's an experience. It's an excitement. It's a good thing. None of this is a lost cause, because we want truth. We want to be expanded. We want to be elevated. And
Truth is very, very powerful. It makes you feel powerful, and that's the key. That is really the key.
It equips you to act.
Oh, that's what it does.
And this is why I think history is so, so important. There's two things I really want to say about why I think the activists, and I mean people knocking on doors, like take it down to that level, need to understand history. The first thing is, if you claim to know about the Constitution or liberty, whatever it is that you're interested in, the fact is that to know the nature of a thing, you have to know the origin of the thing.
Yes.
It's just...
You don't know... You can never know who you are until you understand who you were.
It's so very true. It's so very true. And the other kind of critical reason for learning history, and I'm passionate about this one, is I, like you, am trying to educate not only those who may not get as excited about the concepts of liberty as we do and the Constitution and what it means, but also those who just haven't been exposed to this glorious part of our life, of American life. But when I'm talking to those who are already on our side, I want to educate them in a way that makes them more effective at implementing, as it were, acting out their passion. And so many of them have pet theories. There's a lot of libertarians with these like kind of simple little kind of little orthodoxies, right? They've got pat answers to big questions. But
history
tells us that that's not enough to actually make a real difference in practical politics and in the practical lives of millions of people. Having those kind of nice, neat theoretical ideas, that doesn't change the course of history, of people's lives as experienced day to day. To understand how to go from those ideas to the practical effect, to making the difference in the messy world in which we live, where you have people with all kinds of motivations, as many motivations and sets of motivations as there are different minds in the country, people with different agendas, forces against which we have to act. To understand how people have negotiated that in the past successfully, you have to go to history. What is it that the activists who were successful actually did before? It's not just philosophy. It's the connection of philosophy to practical reality.
Well, yeah, and it's a matter of why repeat mistakes when you have hard-won lessons where you can actually learn from mistakes and then purposely repeat the good things. I've actually written a book. It's called Liberty First, The Path to Restoring America. And I teach a 5-hour workshop every Saturday, which goes through this Roots of Liberty. I teach the history of the 700 years of the history Constitution, and then I walk through the Bill of Rights 1 through 10. I do not engage in philosophical interpretation of history or the Constitution. Everything that I teach is based on historical fact and the words and the framers themselves. And that truth is very, very inspirational. It's very, very empowering. And the people always ask me afterwards, Chrisanne, all right, we get it. Now what do we do? How do we fix this? And so that's why I wrote that book, Liberty First, The Path to Restoring America, because what I did is exactly what you said. I went through history and I gleaned, what has worked for liberty fighters in the past? And I said to myself, how do I change what has worked in the past and modernize it to what will work in the future? And so I came up, or in modern day times, and so I came up with 10 things that we can do that have worked throughout history but applied them in our modern world.
Go on. We've got a minute. Give us an example. A minute in the
Okay. Time. Well, okay, so exactly what you and I do, becoming new media. We need to take back the informational avenues. This was an example set by Sam Adams, Richard Henry Lee, and James Otis Jr. in their creation of the Committees of Correspondence. Because the Committees of Correspondence were designed to unite people of like-minded liberty ideas and then take the truth and disseminate it to them, teaching each other the truth in the face of the government-controlled media, because George III had control of all the newspapers and was handing out all his propaganda. And the Committees of Correspondence were anti-propaganda, new media truth bringers. And that's what we need to do. We need to reclaim and become the new media.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. This is Robin Kerner speaking with my friend Chris Ann Hall. And Chris Ann, you know, one of the things that occurs to me about the American ignorance of history, and I don't know if what you think about this, but yeah, there's this American founding myth, which doesn't really take into account the long tradition in which America was founded, a tradition that was about 760 years old by the time that the Constitution was written.
Right.
And in this myth, kind of the founders came up with liberty, you know, and they came up with it in opposition to a tyrannical monarchy. And so America is not a monarchy. And I think this is really problematic because the United States presidency is more like a Tudor monarchy, and the current monarchy is in Britain, the country from
which,
you know, America separated. That's not like a monarchy like the Americans have. I mean, in America, the president can sign an executive order. In the United Kingdom, the Queen can't do that, and indeed, the Prime Minister can't do that. So, how is it that America has slid back? Even if you're being nice about it, certainly a 17th century kind of monarchy in its presidency, whilst believing that they're this glorious people's republic.
Well, the interesting thing is that George III never even issued an executive order or what they called decrees back then. Our framers hadn't seen a decree since 1688.
Exactly. And the last time, that last decree by an English monarch was James, right?
Right, that was James. James issued a decree. So the interesting thing about James is this. Kings always learn from other kings. They learn how to be tyrannical and not lose their head. And so James has learned, I'm going to engage in the malignant and pernicious design, and I'm going to distract the people from that design by giving them, I'm going to toss them a bone. I'm going to give them something they've never had before. And so he issues a decree that establishes a type of religious liberty. But he says, You no longer have to be a member of the Church of England. You can be a you can go to church anywhere you want, do anything you want, preach anything you want with any people you want. But the decree says that before you have church, you must inform the king where you'll be meeting, who will be preaching, what will be said, who you'll be meeting with, and you have to promise that you will never, ever, ever say anything that might even be construed as a criticism of the king. And then James demanded that all these decrees be read in the churches. And so to me, that doesn't sound like religious liberty. That sounds like a 501c3.
You would say it's kind of maybe using religious liberty as a cover for securing his own power and putting down dissent against the monarch, right?
Absolutely, because you can't say anything to criticize the king. See, these bishops who were told to read this decree in the churches refused. There were seven of them that refused. And what they did was they reminded James that they had a promise from Henry I that kings could not be in the churches. A promise that said that the church will be wholly free from government intrusion. Mm-hmm. And so the bishops are saying to the king, we're not reading anything because you have no right to dictate to the church what we can and cannot do. So James throws them in prison, charges them with a crime called seditious libel, which is the aspect of his decree that says you can't disagree with the king. But the interesting thing is, seditious libel is written in such a way that James has nothing to fear. See, James is going to give them their day in court, but seditious libel says that truth is no defense. So even if you're correct in your criticism of the king, you have to die because you can't criticize the king. And yet we have a king today, do we not? Do you remember the rodeo clown ordeal?
No.
A rodeo clown who put on a mask of Barack Obama and was clowning around during a rodeo while he was being chased by a bull. Well, apparently this is a tradition of this particular rodeo clown. He puts on the mask of the current president.
Oh, Chrisanne, you're going to have to hold on to the story. This sounds great. We're going into a break. Now, Chrisanne, you were just beginning to tell a story about the president and a rodeo clown.
Yes, yeah, so last year, I believe it was last year sometime, there was a tradition in one of the major rodeos in our country where a rodeo clown puts on a mask of the current president and then clowns around in the ring and lets a bull chase him and do whatever, you know, rodeo clowns do. Well, that year, he put on the mask of Barack Obama. And there was such outrage. This man was banned from being a rodeo clown. He was attacked by the media for being racist. And to me, that's just another application of seditious libel. You cannot say anything that might even be construed as a criticism of the king. And we have this president now who behaves like a monarch.
With executive orders that go much further than any executive order signed by any monarch in Britain for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, there's a king, when I teach the history of the 700 years, there's a king that sounds very, very familiar to us. His name is Charles I. He's also called Charles Stuart. And Charles Stuart is recorded in history as being a massive spending king. And even the British history books say that Charles loved to romp about Europe, spending on his every whim and fancy. But he's spending the taxpayers' dollars. And Parliament at that time gets sick and tired of Charles spending and tells him, we're not going to pass any more of your laws until you stop this wasteful spending. Charles says, fine, but, you know, I'm the king, and dissolves Parliament. He says, what do I need Parliament for, you know? And the curious thing is, we think about him dissolving Parliament like he chased them out of the court. But did he really have to do that, Robin? Could he have just said, where Parliament refuses to legislate, I'll just regulate? Or say,
or say, where Parliament won't pass laws, I will, because after all, I have a quill and a messenger.
Right.
And so what we have here is a king who is dissolving the legislative body. He's going to issue a decree to collect the people's money. He's not going to call it a tax. Because, you know, if he calls it a tax, he'd be tyrannical now, because there's, the Magna Carta says, there's no taxation without legislation. He's got rid of the legislation. And so he passes a decree, an executive order, basically, and says, I'm going to collect the people's money, but I'm not going to call it a tax. He calls it a forced loan. Mm-hmm. So here we have the same manipulation of terminology. It's not a tax. It's a mandate. And then, you know, you have the people trying to say, no, this is unconstitutional. There are seven knights that stand up to Charles and say, this is a violation of our constitutional charter. We are not going to enforce this law, and we're not going to comply. And Charles throws them in prison. And from this process, we get a revolution that births a document called the Petition of Right of 1628. Now, Charles signs the Petition of Right the same way John did, with a sword at his throat. But they let Charles be king. And Charles is still reigning the way he has, but now he's coming up with excuses to spend. Charles is collecting their money and telling the people of Great Britain, I need your money because we've got all these foreign wars. The Moors, the Catholics, the Protestants are all fighting each other all over Europe for power and territory. And Charles is telling the people of Great Britain, give me your money so I can fund our allies in these foreign wars. I'll fund our allies in these foreign wars so we don't have to fight the wars at home. And so basically what he's trying to tell the people of Great Britain, it's a matter of national security that I collect your taxes. And Charles is also having civil eruptions because he's not keeping his promises. There are civil wars going on that are called the Bishop Wars. There's a very famous woman by the name of Jenny Geddes in Scotland who is attributed to being the igniter of these civil eruptions. She gets sick and tired of Charles' interference at the pulpit, the government telling the bishops what they can and cannot say. And she stands up in the middle of church and throws her stool at the pulpit, which ignites a riot in the church, which spills out into the streets and starts these bishop wars all over Great Britain. So Charles is now spending the people's money, telling them that he's funding his allies so they don't have to fight their wars at home. They could have the allies fight it for them. But the people are realizing that Charles is talking out of both sides of his mouth. Charles is not funding their allies. He's funding their enemies in these foreign wars because the enemies have promised that they will help Charles get control of his civil eruptions. Charles ends up losing his head over this. They charge him with treason and chop off his head. But we get this brilliant document called the Grand Remonstrance of 1641. And now remember, we've established, right, that we're so much smarter now than we were back then, right? We're technologically advanced, so we're absolutely brilliant compared to what they were. But in 1641, they said in this Grand Remonstrance, the root of all this mischief we find to be a malignant and pernicious design, subverting the fundamental laws and liberties of our kingdom. And then they went and identified this design, because what they're saying is we've been watching tyrants now for 600 years. We're noticing a pattern. They're doing the same things over and over again. Here is the pattern. Step number one, corruption of the court system. Infiltration of foreign law, 2. 3, diminish the property rights of the people. 4, take over the leaderships of the churches so you can control the church and the people. 5, create a fiat money so that we can manipulate the monetary system. Charles was taking them off the gold and silver standard and creating brass fiat money. 6, disarm the people while the government stays armed. These are what we chopped off heads for in 1641, Robin.
And you know what? I don't know if you know this, Kazan, but one year either side of that were one quarter of all of the impeachments in English history.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that. I learn stuff from you all the time.
Well, I learned not as much as I learned from you, that's for sure. But, you know, this is really interesting as an example because, you know, you talked about, was it the seven knights? And they're reacting to, effectively, abusive taxation. You have Gillis,
right,
who's reacting, again, as a private individual. I mean, she's not acting, you know, she's not acting through a political process as a political, you know, entity or representative. She's just acting as a common person who feels that the overreach of power beyond the political into everyday life, which I call into the culture, is making her tomorrow's worse than her yesterday. Something that she already feels she has, her natural rights that she has had an experience of enjoying as a, you know, a free in quotes person, have been removed. And it was in that, it was because of that, it was because of that overstep of power, that overreach of power, whether on the financial side, in the religious freedom or the freedom of speech side, that caused the fight back. And the ultimate, the ultimate way this played out is, you know, power takes one step forward too far, but liberty wins two steps because they resisted, and in resisting, they turned the notch of liberty one notch in the right, you know, the ratchet of liberty one notch in the right direction. And I think this is such an important lesson from history that you see time and time again. It's no good, liberty folks now, going around teaching some kind of libertarian worldview as if they're going to convert 300 million people intellectually. That's not how it works. How it works is you get people to focus on that one thing, that one offense against their liberty that is felt, right, in their everyday lives. And then the movement starts in the culture. And then what happens politically is the consequence. It kind of comes second. But we have to feel that offense against our liberty in the culture.
Well, think about it. The whole revolution that was the Glorious Revolution of 1688 that came against James II was because the bishops got tired of the government telling the church what it can and cannot do. And so even then, we have the church taking back the liberty of the people. And we have, you know, I mean, today it's considered heresy for a church to be involved in politics. But, you know, you have hit on a fundamental point. I've written a book called Liberty First, The Path to Restoring America. And what I've done is I've taken these events throughout history and what has worked in history for to ignite the people to win back liberty, to establish a Liberty First perspective. And what I've done,
hold on, because we're going into the
okay.
last break. Hey, Chrisanne, when we went for that final break, you were just telling us about your book. Something
yes.
related to our last segment. Just finish that thought.
Yeah. The Liberty First, The Path to Restoring America, some things that I've pulled out of history that have worked in the past. For example, the committees of correspondence started by Sam Adams, Richard Henry Lee, and James Otis Jr., the purpose was for them to create a new media to overturn the propaganda put out by George III's ownership of all and control of all the newspapers. And so what we need to do today is follow the path of our history, the things that have worked, you know, like the committees of correspondence, like what you and I are doing with our radio shows and the article writings and that sort of thing. What we're doing is we're overturning government propaganda by teaching people the truth. And the truth is the only thing that will empower people to actually ignite and inspire them to act.
That's so, so true. No kind of irony intended. But now, Chrisanne, if people want to learn some of this truth, and I mean, the best thing they can do is go to your classes because they're brilliant. But if you're not in their city right now, because even you can only be in one city at a time, although I'm sure you're working on that, where can they go?
They can go to my website, chrisannehall.com, K-R-I-S. ANNEHALL.com. And they should know if they want me to come and teach, I don't have any speaking fees. I don't charge anything for what I do, and I don't require reimbursement for travel or accommodations. This really is a ministry for me and my family. And so all they need to do is invite me, and I love to teach this because, like you, I believe this is the essential key to restoring the Republic.
Absolutely. Chrisanne, thank you for joining me. Thank you to all my listeners for joining Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. Come back again same time next week. You know we always have great guests. I have a lot of fun doing this, and I look forward to sharing my time with you.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.